Hello, hello, can you hear me? I hear myself. Good afternoon, how you guys doing? Kind of not very good out there, huh? Need more participation, right? All right, well, my name is John Harris, and I'm a self-unemployed brewer right now. I'm working on getting my own brewery started, and hopefully on Monday I'll sign a lease and I can have a name and be a brewer again, so I'm pretty excited about that. But this is my 15th year doing this troubleshooting panel, which just kind of dates myself. My beard has gone gray, and I need some troubleshooting help with my beard. Anyhow, you guys are asleep today.
That's for men.
Okay, no more jokes, I promise. Anyhow, but here, this is an open forum. We're here to answer, me and the panelists are here to answer any questions you have that are troubling you in your brewery. So it really is, we need your participation. And so, I'm going to move this down a little bit. That works still. So hopefully you'll come with your questions so that we may answer them. So I've been brewing for about 27 years, so not much in the last year. And I just want to talk a little bit about troubleshooting. I really think that in a brewery, you really need to use all your senses. You need to know, you use your sense of sight. You look around your brewery, you see if things are right. You know, is the valves positioned in the way you like them? Does the malt look right? Do the hops look right? The sense of sound even comes into play, the sense of that good old whiny chiller you have that is at a high frequency that bugs you every Friday at the end of the week. And does it sound right? Does the pump sound right? Does the compressor sound right? Does the body line have the cling you're used to? Of course, we always think of our sense of touch. I mean, touch, handling raw materials, handling hops, of course, which we all love to do in the fall, to rub the hops. So your sense of touch really comes into play, as does your sense of smell. Does your brewery smell right? There's a certain odor when you brew certain types of beers, and there's a certain odor of the ferment on day one and the ferment on day five. And things like that. As I remember walking through a brewery a while back, and I was smelling ammonia, and the brewer said, "Well, that's normal." I left pretty much right away, you know. So, rest in peace. Anyhow, and then of course your sense of taste, which is what we all love being brewers, is to taste our product. But I always like to encourage people to taste. Make sure you taste everything. You taste your water. You taste your malt. You taste your yeast. You taste your beer every day of fermentation, so you get to know what is normal and what isn't normal. So, I really feel that when you start to troubleshoot in the brewery, you really need to. You know, be aware and use all of your senses and really get to know your brewery and what it really is supposed to, you know, look, see, smell, feel, all that stuff. I just think it's really important. So what I like to do is I ask our panelists to give a quick introduction of themselves and their position, and then give them a little quick how you actually approach troubleshooting problems in your brewery. So Scott, we're Scott here.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. I'm Scott Jennings. I work at Sierra Nevada Brewing Company.
Can you guys hear him?
Yeah. Can you hear me? Is this on? Okay. Quick history. I've been with Sierra Nevada for 12 years. I worked in the Chico plant as a production brewer for 4 years, and then I moved into R&D, and I was the head brewer of R&D for 8 years, and now I'm the head brewer of the new brewery in Asheville, North Carolina. Troubleshooting. Boy, there's a lot of stuff that can happen, huh? I appreciate what John just said about the using all of your senses, you know. Everybody knows that you get to be very familiar with your brew house and all of your equipment. And you kind of develop a sense of awareness that you just know when something is not quite right. But there are always these problems, too, that come up, and you just, they're a little bit more challenging. Take micro, for example. That can be a little more challenging. One of the things that I would just say, just as an introduction, that I've found to be probably the most important and valuable strategy for troubleshooting the harder things is diligent documentation of not only what you have done, but all of your observations and so on, too, because you can then create a record of where you've been when you're trying to solve the problem, and it sometimes can become a lot more clear what the next step might be after that.
Hi, my name is Wayne Wombles. I'm the brewmaster for Cigar City Brewing. I was the first employee there. Been brewing beer for 15, 16 years commercially. We try to approach troubleshooting from a preventative stance. Sometimes you end up having to be reactive. We'd rather be proactive. Basically, we have a small lab that we've only had since probably the middle of last year. Highly recommend if you don't have a small lab, you should definitely have one, especially by the time you reach between 7,000 and 7,500 barrels annually, preferably before then at least something small like a microscope with a hemocytometer, just something so you can see what the heck you're doing. Also, it doesn't hurt to have a Zahm bottle, galtometer, it's the next step. I encourage you, if you can't afford it, to purchase equipment to better be able to analyze your product and troubleshoot it.
Jason Oliver, founder and head brewer at Devil's Backbone Brewing Company. Started a little over 4 years ago as a brew pub in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, and opened a production facility about a year and a quarter ago, also in Central Virginia. I guess my philosophy on troubleshooting is, first I check to see if it's plugged in, and you know, look at the simple things first. I mean, that's sort of like, you know, start at the bottom and then get into more complex things, because you'll be amazed how simple some things can be, and you kind of glance over it when you're just looking a little too deep sometimes. And also, I think it's really important to have a good network of colleagues that you can bounce ideas off of. You know, I think there's so much information collectively in the, you know, the brewing industry here, and we've seen, you know, there's pretty much nothing that one of you hasn't seen in your, you know, collective careers, whether it's like major blunders or, you know, acts of God and or just the little things. So, you know, have your circle of friends, colleagues you trust, you respect, and bounce ideas off of. I mean, Larry, he's like one of my go-to guys. You know, I send him emails, give him a call. So, you know, have you know, some of your friends in the industry that you trust, and you know, talk to them.
My name is Eric Warner, and I started off my brewing career about 25 years ago, graduating from Weinstephan over in Germany, where I learned nothing about troubleshooting because it was all very high-level theory, and then proceeded to start up a brewery where I was doing troubleshooting 24/7, and but have continued to see all kinds of things pop up, and you never stop learning, obviously. Now with Carbach Brewing Company, a startup down in Houston, Texas, and we were kind of fortunate enough to put together a partnership group. We were able to build a pretty nice brewery out of the block, so that's hopefully for now avoiding a lot of troubles, but they always come, and my philosophy definitely echo a couple of things about simplicity and relying on your colleagues or the brewing community or even your vendors or equipment suppliers to help you. That obviously can be a double-edged sword. You know, I also, in the line of simplicity, take time to assess the situation a little bit. Most of our situations aren't that dire. We're not like ER doctors or EMTs. We got a few minutes to take a breath and assess the situation. I think PMs go a long way. You know, make sure you're taking care of your equipment and it will take care of you. I've seen a lot of troubles arise in a brewery, and it's like, again, along the line of simplicity. Oh, the compressor's not working anymore. No oil. Go figure. Along the lines of information and measurement, also, you know, don't let one outlier necessarily freak you out. One measurement is not a trend make. So make sure, unless it's micro, then obviously that's a little more different story. Don't, you know, the more complicated the system, the more complications you can bring with it. Think sort of German cars versus Japanese cars and maintenance costs. And then, yeah, at the end of the day, use your gut. You know, you guys have been doing this for a while, either professionally or as home brewers, and if you're using all your senses, you usually make the right call.
Looks like we're going to need some troubleshooting right here. My name is Larry Horowitz. I'm the regional brewer for Iron Hill Brewery and Restaurant. We've got 9.5 brewery restaurants in the Philly metro area, and we have broken or damaged everything that you can think of and some things that you haven't. I can say that if you, you know, it's trite, but we're going to talk about it a lot. If you run it to fail, it will fail to run. I actually heard a talk about that recently where a very famous maintenance technician suggested that we should run everything to fail because then we'd get every last bit of use out of it. In my experience, it always fails at the wrong time. So be proactive about fixing or replacing the things in your brewery that are broken. Don't work around broken equipment. Broken equipment's not safe. It's not good for your beer. It's not good for your people. Do keep great records. Learn your rig. You know, keep a three-ring binder, especially if you're a pub brewery. The manufacturer probably gave you one when it started, when you opened up, and it ended up in the bottom of a drawer somewhere. Fish it out and get it on a shelf. Keep track of part numbers for your pumps, your traps. Anytime you buy something new, keep the instructions. You know, those things are really easy. Like the Gooch said, is it plugged in, or did you install it backwards, or did you give it the wrong voltage for 6 months, and maybe that's why it's not working now? And do take good pictures. When you find stuff that's destroyed or damaged, keep a record of it. You know, snap a couple quick photos of something before you chuck it in the trash. We ended up finding a whole batch of bad condensate pumps just by keeping decent records about when they failed. And the manufacturer eventually was like, yeah, our bad. I guess we owe you about a dozen of those. So, you know, keep track of what's going on in your place and learn your own rig.
All right, thanks, guys. All right, so now we turn to the lovely audience and see if anybody has a question they'd like to give to the panel. Of course, I'd like if you move to the microphone, it'd be great. Or we could take it live and we'll just repeat the question back for the recording.
I'll break the ice. Larry, right, question for you.
Sure.
What do you do to avoid chasing after a red herring when it comes to
I get this one a lot because I tend to be the guy that gets the phone call. Hey, this is broken and I'm leaving.
Larry? Can you repeat the question back for the recording?
Sure. So the question was, how do you avoid chasing a red herring? I use the Jason Oliver troubleshooting method, which is to start with the basics. You know, especially if you're working from a distance through somebody who's working on the project. You know, are you using the device in question in the way that it was intended to operate? You know, is it start? You know, does it have the energy that it needs? Is it plugged in and operating? You know. What is changed that's causing the person who's saying it's broken to identify the item as broken? I mean, believe it or not, this is a big one, right? This thing's not working. Well, what has led you to believe that it's not working? You know, that's one way to do it. And on the other side of that is, if you're using a vendor to repair your items especially, make sure that your vendor knows at least as much as you do about what's wrong that they've come to fix. And if they don't, make sure you glue yourself to their hip until they leave the building. You know, that has the added benefit of making sure they bill you for the right hours.
You have anything to add?
I would just tag on to that as far as the vendors go and what you were saying there. A lot of new vendors out there that I've never seen before this last 2 days, so I think that's an excellent point. And obviously a lot of folks starting up breweries, you know, you're trying to do it on a tight budget. And sometimes you are going to say, I'm going to buy this because of price. But, yeah, these guys may think they know more than you, but they may not.
Yeah, one other thing just reminded me, Eric, that when you do get something from a vendor or something new, whatever it is, make sure you take the time to get every ounce of information and training about that piece of equipment that you can, because that'll serve you. When you need service or something happens, if you can really accurately describe exactly what is going on with the thing to the manufacturer, that can save you a ton of time. And plus, then you have a better understanding of, you know, are you getting the fix that you really, really need, or are you getting a new piece of equipment when maybe you don't need it, for example, stuff like that. A lot of times that stuff is kind of part of the deal, or it can be negotiated as part of the deal when you buy something like a galvanometer or something like that.
Go ahead.
So I have two questions, if that's cool.
with you guys. First one would be a wort pump. Our wort pump's constantly leaking. Like once a month, the gas goes out on it. I've heard it's from the expansion when the beer is at 212 degrees and you start your whirlpool, that the air is actually coming out of liquid solution, causing it to grind down. In almost every brewery I've ever been to, the wort pump's constantly leaking. Do you have any solutions for that?
It's a
4V2 pump. I can't recall the name of the company right now, but the design on it basically is a ceramic disc that's on the back of a spring that comes against a stainless steel disc, and that's what holds it in place and keeps basically the fluid from escaping.
How big?
What's that?
How big?
Inch and a half ports. It's a 2-horsepower pump.
So relatively small. I'm assuming this is a small brewery.
It's a 30-barrel brewery.
Oh, that's... It's a pretty decent-sized brewery.
Yeah.
I'll start off just because of the microphone that's up in front of me. We've discovered that, you know, if you look across most of the breweries, especially on the pub end or the relatively small craft end, it's kind of a one-stop shop. The manufacturer of your brewery likely bought one or eight of the same pump, and it's probably the same one throughout your entire facility. They're definitely not designed to do everything that we ask them to do. Our wort pumps leak a lot. We've got two things that help us. One is make sure the shaft is straight. You got to pay attention to that. They do come out around. Two, we're using Viton seal kits now instead of Buna, where we can get it done. And if it's a straight centrifugal that's got a spring in the set, make sure you replace the spring. I know guys are trying to squeeze a buck when they replace the seal kits. They'll just get the consumable rubber and not replace the whole kit. Do replace the whole kit. And the last one is make sure it's plumbed right. You know, if you're getting breakout, you know, of oxygen there because it's banging and cavitating, then you need a little more restriction on the outflow, even if that means just throwing a valve in there.
So our valve on the outflow for our whirlpool is a 3/4 inch coming out of the 1.5 inch, so there's plenty of restriction at that point.
Sure. Check the shaft.
All right, because we replaced the bearings, too, because I noticed on the plate there was an oval wobble, and that was coming from the bearings.
Oh, yeah, there you go. I mean, if you got an oval wobble, ditch the bearings.
Yeah, we did that already. But we're still about once every month or every 2 months we're getting a leak and having to switch out the seals on it.
You'll never get that shaft straight again. You know, I don't care how many hammers go after that thing. Once it's going in a wobble, you're finished.
Cool.
Sorry to give you bad news.
Switch the shaft.
That's an expensive fix. But
no, I understand. That's cool. Yeah.
He also had a really good point about the Viton. That's a really good point.
I've heard about that, too, going with the Viton.
Yeah, and if not Viton, there are some pretty notorious incompatibilities with certain cleaning chemicals and certain soft goods.
Yep.
And you can just go to on the web or whoever supplies the seal kits, and there should be a list of you know, what's compatible and what isn't. And you can check your MSDSs to verify that you've got compatible seals.
How long does it take you to transfer over?
Transfer over for us is in the wintertime when the water's cold, city water's cold. We're about 40 minutes, 30-barrel batch. And then summertime when the water's really warm, it's about an hour and 10.
And you're going into a whirlpool or just...
No, years? Transferred over from the kettle to the fermenter. Whirlpool's in the same tank as the kettle. It's the same. But that kind of answers the first question. Second question, we don't have a lot of room on our facility, so we can't have a giant CO2 tank, so we're running a heater on our CO2, and our heaters are just going out constantly, and our distributor for our CO2 is replacing them, but I was just wondering something that's a little more bulletproof than just a standard inline heater, if you guys have an idea.
So we're talking CO2 vaporizer?
Basically, yep.
Yeah. There's a lot of heat exchangers that are out there that use just hot water if you have a surplus of hot water.
Which nobody
those
has.
Are out there. Most breweries do. But, that's what we use.
Cool. So a heat exchanger.
I'm assuming that you say you have a 4-vessel 30-barrel or a 30-barrel brew house?
We have a 2-vessel 30-barrel brew house.
So I'm assuming you're moving enough volume to be able to potentially bring in like a bulk CO2 tank, or are you talking about like a big
So yeah, CO2? We could bring in a bulk CO2 tank, but we don't have the room to put in a bulk CO2 tank indoors or outdoors because we're in city limits, so we can't really put anything outdoors. And indoors, we're pretty much jam-packed, so we can't really put in, say, what is it, like a 10,000-pound vessel, I believe, is the next size up.
Ever since we put ours in, we rarely have freezing problems.
How big is your CO2 tank?
How big is it?
Yeah, how many poundage? Because we're running four 750s.
It's huge. It's like, I don't know, it's 20 feet tall or something. It's massive.
Wow.
And it has these things also have like built-in telemetry, so if the tank's getting low, it calls the company. If there's a problem with the tank, it calls the company. Highly recommend, if you could, go with something like that. That would be ideal. It's all plumbed in with copper. Mm-hmm. We rarely have freezing problems, if ever.
Cool. That's it.
Really ghetto, and I hesitate to recommend it because of safety concerns, but you can dribble a little warm water on the regulator.
Yeah, I've done that before.
Wonders. Yeah. It's a little wasteful as well, but until you can get your bulk tank
I've also warmed up the tanks, the coils on the tanks, get the tanks nice and warm again. That's worked, but it doesn't work in the middle of a 1,000 case canning run. Thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah, I don't know if this will help. Just came to mind, and it probably might not be warm enough, but there's like, if you could wrap the regulator maybe with heat trays, that keeps pipes from freezing. I don't know. It might help.
They also make heated regulators, but they're pretty expensive.
So don't know how close to get. That's awkward. Recently, we were having boiler issues, and we fixed it since that point. But we were discussing what we would ever do if the boiler actually went down for an amount of time when we actually loudered back in and we couldn't boil. I don't know if that's ever occurred to y'all, what you would do at that point with your water. If you couldn't get your boiler back up that day, what would you do with your 20 barrels of wort?
You got a great experimental beer in the works.
I don't know what you could do. I really don't. You could, if there was a way to cool it down, no, that wouldn't be good either.
Send it to the drain.
Yeah, what would you?
Is that really it?
That's what we would do. We would send it to the drain.
Yeah.
But we had some issues sort of like that recently, mm-hmm. and we're like, we'll get the boiler up in a few hours, and we'll just go ahead and run process. And then what you end up with in the end is a subpar product that you're going to have to dump anyway. So mm-hmm. you might as well dump it now. And save on time and production, then try to make it work later. That's just how we would approach it.
It's what we came to too. But
our 10 barrel batches, the grist sitting in there is $300-$500, but by the time you get 28 days down the road, that number just quadrupled. Unless you got barrels to shove it in, send it to the drain.
That kind of brings up a general thought on that regard. It may not be applicable for brew pubs or really small operations, but the more modular you can go with steam and refrigeration, the better off you're going to be in case any one fails. You're not dead in the water.
All right. Does anybody else have another question?
Sensory is important. It absolutely is to test everything, but how do you deal with incremental house fires? Like the story you mentioned, John, about the guy said, you get the ammonia in here. You might have gotten so used to it, you didn't even notice it was there anymore. But the family you did in that case, how do you deal with incremental house fires? Perhaps you're the only one in there, working in the facility, and somebody finally comes in and says, God, where the hell's the hydrogen sulfide coming from?
I've got an easy one for you.
One second. So we want to talk about Repeat the question, Larry, please.
So the question was, how do you deal with incremental house bias? So something that's going wrong in your facility that you just don't notice because it got worse and worse over time. For us, it's filter pump motors. For whatever reason, they die, right? They tend to get, when they've just been rebuilt or they're brand new, they're not at all loud. And, you know, 4, 5, 6, 9, 12 months down the road, you can't walk in the facility without losing your hearing. And I firmly believe that I have hearing loss from these pumps and motor assemblies. You know, the trick to that one is to get somebody that isn't you in your facility every once in a while, if you have the capability to do that. And if you don't, come up with an audit list, as part of your routine maintenance to say, all right, what things do we know fail on a regular basis that cause problems that we're not likely to see or notice that we can check with some sort of measurement that isn't our five senses, you know? What's the standing temperature of your glycol reservoir? Has it started to scoot? You know, how loud is that pump and motor assembly? Is it really time to break that thing apart and work on the seal kits?
Anybody else?
You're talking, you were kind of addressing sensory too, right?
Yeah, and you know, as Larry mentioned, you know, sound or taste or, you know, aroma, you know, you don't notice it all the time. I mean, we've had a couple of cases of breweries that have gone so chock full of diacetyl at the end of the day, they didn't notice until finally a customer said, where the hell is the fire coming?
Well, a couple things there. One, get outside tasters for sure, both sort of qualified and unqualified. And by that I mean qualified folks who you know can perceive some of the key off flavors at the threshold level, can perceive the basic taste. Unqualified, somebody who's like, yeah, I like beer. I'd love to taste your beer. And there's value in each of those. I think also, I hate to say it, but social media and even some of the ratings websites you got to be careful of, because there's talk about bias. If it's not 10% and 100 IBUs, nobody's going to care about it. But look at your social media. People are out there talking about your beer, whether you're aware of it or not.
And I guess we haven't probably addressed that in-house, but along those lines, I think take every comment and concern seriously. So if someone says, oh, I just got a six-pack of your beer and, you know, it's not tasting like it did on draft, or, and you go out there, you know, you track it down, but never dismiss it. And even if you initially can't tell the difference, I mean, I think it's very important, the fact that, you know, someone's picking up on something, that is a problem, you know. Just never dismiss those things from outside. You know, everything is important. So I don't know if that's somewhat similar. But.
So I think it kind of goes back a little bit to really a general practice in troubleshooting, being sometimes you can learn a lot from the perspective of somebody else who comes in to, you know, check out what you have going on. And that can be, you know, even somebody who doesn't know a heck of a lot about pumps or isn't a brewer necessarily. Maybe it can be front of the house people for pub breweries or something like that. I mean, just get a fresh set of eyes on something. And I was just in a plant just last week where they had a pretty cool troubleshooting or say qualitative housekeeping type program going on. So they had a checklist that they developed, and that was based on a lot of years of documentation and noting different areas where there were little issues here and there, different things that would happen. And so they developed this checklist. And then once a week for a period of, I want to say, 2 months, they would assign the task for somebody to go around the plant with their checklist and look at all the items that are on the list. And this person would rotate, and it would be somebody new all the time. It might be somebody who never worked in that area, and they might not even know exactly where to go at first to look at all the things that are on the list. But they found that when you put a new set of eyes on something, you get a new perspective on it. And it's something that, you know, you might have become blind to over the years. All of a sudden, yeah, you know, I remember thinking that was a problem, but then I forgot all about it, or I got used to it, or something like that. So, and then to follow that up, you document that information. And then And that way you can, over time, modify your list and determine what's more important and what's less important, things that need more attention, things that need less attention. You know what I mean? It's a process, definitely.
I think you guys covered it pretty well.
We lead into another one, and actually, I had another question, and Larry alluded to it as well. We're seeing a lot of situations now, a lot of brewers have been out there long enough now that we're beginning to see some glycol leaks, glycol failures. I don't know if you have any questions, any comments for the guys out here about how to deal best with glycol systems. And checking seals, checking for leaks. Do you recommend that you have dye in the glycol system?
That's what we do. Yeah, we use trace dye. Mm-hmm.
We have to repeat the question. So,
What are some things you can do to determine whether you have glycol leaks, or to be proactive so that if you do, you can notice that you have glycol leaks? We use trace dye in a reservoir. It's multiple different colors you can get. We happen to use pink. So when someone's walking by and they see a pink puddle on the floor, it's the saying as well, who spilled Kool-Aid on the floor? That just basically tells us, you know, we've got a leak, we've got to, you know, find where it's coming from, but we know it's somewhere in this vicinity. So that's usually how we handle it.
Yeah, we had an issue several months ago where Houston, the water is pretty warm in the summer coming off the tap, so kind of got everybody schooled to drink off the cold liquor tank. And so we kind of always have a little check that way, and all of a sudden the cold liquor was like foamy and tasted a little funny and even slightly sweet. And we, you know, we're kind of, how did our water system fail or whatever? And the hunch was that it was glycol, and threw some dye in, and sure enough, the water that we were drinking turned green.
And don't drink your glycol. You know, this is something that we've been dealing with just a little bit, specifically related to glycol. Almost all of us out there who have had our glycol maintenance by outside companies probably have inhibitors in it, and those inhibitors probably aren't food grade, because we want our equipment to last longer. So you got to balance your need for food-grade glycol with the longevity of that chemical and, of course, your equipment. But if you're going to be going down that road, I recommend 100% you get some dye in that glycol, because you need to see when that leaks. Because it went from a level of a low-grade annoyance and maybe some loss of food-grade antifreeze up to the, now I got a potential contact with my product that's not edible, you know?
Yeah, kind of follow up on that and back to the whole thing with all these new vendors. There's a lot of tanks coming from all over the world right now at different price points. And so make sure when you're, you know, if you have a leak from your jacket to the inside of your tank, that's going to be tough to spot, especially if it's a pinhole. So really make sure, you know, you tend to focus on the Kroisen ring when you're looking at, you know, how clean your tank is. But also you want to inspect the jackets, too, as much as you can with a lamp and make sure you don't see anything there. And if you're really, you know, if you're suspicious of it, just leave the tank closed for, you know, overnight. Of course, most of us are trying to brew into that fermenter right away, but if you can let it sit for overnight, you'll get a puddle of something at the bottom.
Say look in the reservoir too. If you see it going down, it's going somewhere.
The glycol genies, right? Yeah, just food coloring works too for the glycol. Not any special dye. We always use just red food coloring. Go to the glycol reservoir. Got a gallon of it. Cheap. Anybody have another question? There's no troubles out there, I see.
Got one for what ended up, how did the glycol end up getting into the cold liquor?
It was, we have a heat exchanger that we run our cold liquor through. And so it was a brazed heat exchanger, and it expanded, it froze and expanded, so the glycol was mixing in with the water. And like I say, thank God, and that's again back to the senses thing. you know, try your beer every day, your fermenting beer, try your ingredients, try your liquor, your water, you know, use all your senses, because 9 times out of 10 you'll spot a problem that way. And yeah, fortunately we didn't end up using any of that water to brew with. We used food grade, so it wouldn't have been an issue, but still.
Anybody else have a question?
If you suspect that there's glycol in your beer, what would be the easiest way to test for that? Test that batch of beer.
I think I can answer that one and maybe generate a little bit of revenue at the same time. We actually have been asked that question about once or twice a year for the past 3 or 4 years. I mean, we've had a problem with glycol. And we have a method that we thought we could use and didn't work out until last year when we said we've been stupid. We should be able to detect it by gas chromatography. So if you do suspect you have a problem, I have a very, very quick way now to detect it. Not necessarily the concentration. We're not calibrated at this point, but I have a very, very quick way, within 45 minutes to get the sample to be able to tell you you've definitely got glycol in the system. And then it's your choice to deal with it from that point. Larry said, you know, don't drink. You shouldn't drink glycol. It is food grade glycol. Propylene glycol is used in foodstuffs to give you that mouthfeel and viscosity, so it's not necessarily dangerous. Larry really hit the issue. You know, what about the mineral oils that are coming along with it? What about shavings from the copper shavings or whatever tubing you're coming through? So I would recommend that if you do find glycol in the system, even if you've used food grade, I think you've got to dump that batch of beer, solve the problem, and march on, like you talked about, with the issue of the failed boiler. You know, you don't want wood sitting around getting wood spoilage. You don't want beer that's sitting around getting glycol. Dump it and move on.
Wouldn't you expect a little decreased head retention, too?
It's difficult on the concentration. When we get told about these things, usually it was so low. The earlier method we had can detect standard glycols, but we weren't able to detect it in the beer sample because of the dilution. Now we have a way to concentrate that and run it on the GC, which can test the easily. So I think it depends on how much is leaked. If it's a minor amount, I mean, we can detect it and tell you you've got it in there. It's your call at that point, depending on the food grade issue, whether you want to allow that to go through to your consumer or dump it. But, you know, I'd argue if you have any trace of it at all, dump it and move on, regardless of whether you see anything else. Because I don't think you'll get it in the taste, particularly if you've got a heavily hot beer. So you're not going to find it in the taste, but I don't know about the head retention and issues. You know, if you see it, you know you've got a problem, probably. It's probably obvious at that point. You don't even need to have it tested for glycol if you haven't got it dyed.
It would probably also, obviously, again, it'd have to be in a meaningful quantity, but if you have a good baseline for what your finishing gravities are, say, it'll definitely change your end attenuation.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else have a question?
Sorry, hang up the bag.
Some of that? No? Use a refractometer, you said, to see if it goes up. You say there's glycol in it? Yeah. Anybody else? I'll ask a question then. A lot of people are going to automation, and how do you guys, say you have automation in your plant, how do you know it's actually doing what you want it to do? Anybody want to talk to that one?
Yeah, you know.
It says it's cleaning the tank, and you did it do it right?
Well, that's a good question. I guess you it's pretty easy to get into that mode of thinking where you just assume that what you are seeing on screen is really what's going on, and that's not always the case, obviously. For example, most simply, you won't see any leaks if you don't go away from your desk and walk around. For one thing, and that turns out to be pretty dang important. So you can set up what we call POVs, which is process operator verification, and that's a similar thing to my previous comment about a checklist. And so, for example, you know, you have you're pumping in, okay, and you want to make sure that your receiving tank, the valve opens, obviously. So, you know, a lot of times you don't necessarily get feedback from every piece of equipment that's out there, and you're assuming that it's working. Maybe 90% of the time you're right, and that 10% of the time, or less hopefully, that you're wrong, you're really counting on somebody to actually notice that something's going wrong. And so you can set up, these POVs so you can basically make sure that all of the elements of the process are being physically monitored to some interval. You basically got to get up and go check stuff out and make sure it's all working.
Thanks. Anybody else, sir? None of us have as much automation as here in Nevada does, I know. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of stuff. How many people out in here use automation in any way, shape, or form? Okay. Are we talking brewhouse control, maybe some peripheral equipment, water treatment or something like that? In my experience, the people in the brew house, the brewers are pretty, you're in tune with what's going on. It's a lot of times it's the outside stuff. Maybe it's your CO2 system. Maybe you don't catch something right away and all of a sudden it's all frozen up. Maybe it's, your liquor tank. Maybe it's a pump. I don't know, but it's those outside things that you really have to pay really close attention to. Those can catch up and bite you pretty quick.
Thanks. Anybody else come with got a question now? It's a quiet group. We haven't had a lottery question yet. Anybody have a lottery question? We don't have to take a lottery question, but some years we've had a lot of lottery questions. But so right now a lot of breweries are playing around with lagers, ales, lager ale hybrids, of course, the love of Brettanomyces these days, other wild strains. Anybody have any comments on keeping cross-contamination down, things you might do in your plants just to keep those strains from commingling, how you test for that, things like that? Anybody want to take that one?
We had a widespread Brettrux infection about 2 years ago. A lesson I really didn't want to learn, but I had to, I guess. Basically, we were conducting open fermentation in a horizontal 30-barrel fermenter, and we're using a combination of a Belgian Saison strain and Brettrux. And that same corner was also where we were packaging our beer, which was really stupid. And then so we also had a keg washer back there, and it was discharging into a trench drain. So we're kegging the product, this product with Brux, and we're bottling it as well. And so when these kegs go onto this keg washer, they are exhausting Brux into the air in the same area that we're packaging our product. And then at the same time, I've got employees over there taking bottles, half-full bottles of beer, putting them into a sink, so they can dump them out and take them back and put them back on the line again to run them through again. Well, the Brux is actually coming up into the sink from the keg washer. And so what they're basically doing is taking these bottles, putting them back onto the line, which is going to a sanitizer rinser, which is only like at 100 ppm of peracetic, which is not made to kill Brettrux. So now they're infecting the reservoirs, they're feeding more bottles through their line, and just continues to spin more and more wildly out of control. So basically the first thing we did was stop reusing bottles. We took the keg washer exhaust line and moved it to the exterior of the building, to another drain on the exterior of the building. We stopped using Brettrux in-house, and eventually we were able to get rid of it, but it was a real nightmare.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, my thought on that, that is definitely a hard lesson, and there's a lot of seems like demand or a lot of cachet right now for beers that are brewed or fermented with non-traditional microorganisms. you know, if you're starting up, you kind of want to walk before you run, so to speak, and get all your basic QA processes in place. Make sure, you know, you, because that could have happened with, you know, start with two different yeast strains or three, and then make sure you're managing that well. And then afterwards, if you're confident in that, then you can start doing sour beers.
We're fortunate. We're relatively small tank sizes and not energy sensitive in this issue. We burn it, you know. Given the opportunity to get something hot, get it hot. And don't be lazy when it comes to cleaning critical control points. You know, make it a point to take the fermenter all the way apart. It's got a clamp on it, and it can come off. Take it off, scrub it, inspect the gaskets, put it back together. Especially if you're crossing bio, you know, if you're moving from Hefeweizen yeast to lager, or you are choosing to use a strain like Brettanomyces in your brewery, you might even go so far as to consider trashing the rubber. You know, this is kind of a procedure that's worked really well for us. If we do primary ferments that include potentially contaminating microorganisms, we pull everything that's porous off the tank and stick it in the trash, and we just chalk that up as a cost to operating when it comes to dealing with something that could potentially really gig our house strains.
And this is on a pub level, you know, just like Larry said about the rubber, you know, you're not going to, that will, you know, be possibly, you know, they'll harbor bread and bacteria. So we have a couple little tanks, one with Brett in it and one with some lacto, and we use just separate lines. Don't use pumps on. These are very small tanks, 75-gallon soda tanks, which are actually really kind of cool for this purpose. Yeah, I got one from you. Yeah. anyway, yeah, so, but then Larry said, like, heat, you know, use heat, separate rubber. You're not going to really sanitize that rubber very well. So stainless, you know, you can cook. But, yeah, keep things separate. And then also about the keg washers, we have some dedicated kegs that we use for this. And we always put it on the end of a keg run and then take apart that keg washer and, you know, never followed with kegs that are going to be used for regular beers, and then we really try to clean that keg washer very well too, because we don't want to contaminate via that. So just a couple things we do. And but those small tanks, like, so you're not, I'm not like dedicating a whole tank for this stuff. So just keep things separate, at least that's what we do.
Anybody else? Good question? Great.
Thanks for that. That's helpful. And on another note, we just moved to a bigger brew house. When we did that about 6 months ago, we started plate and frame filtering the beer, just plate and frame. And one day we would love to get to a centrifuge or DE, but we're not there yet. I was wondering if any of you guys have experience just using plate and frame as your primary filtration method. And I'm currently a little skeptical about oxygen pickup. We're definitely noticing some kind of couple months down the road. I mean, could definitely be the bottler as well, but sort of suspecting the plate and frame or a combination. I was wondering if you guys have used those successfully, if you had any tips or tricks.
I'm fortunate my wife is also in the brewing business, and I'm privy to a little information from her about using relatively large plate and frame filter. It is possible when that thing is running tight to keep it from picking up oxygen. A couple of clutch things. When you're cleaning and sanitizing that bad boy, make sure you're purging it out real good. If you're using city water, especially in that process at all, as a huge carrier of DO, and you gotta get rid of it. And I would go so far as to say, you know, discard the heads. Small amount of beer down the drain on the front end will really save you there. You know, and everybody who likes to look for the easy fix, right? Well, is it the filter? Sure. But, I mean, are you purging your hoses? Are you purging your tanks? You know, how are you controlling DO?
And when you say purging, do you mean deaerated water or with CO2? Or?
Yes. Both. You know, I mean.
Both in what order? What is the last thing to hit your hose?
You're a relatively small brewery, so I'm assuming you don't have a DA tank hanging out.
No, we don't.
Right?
Yeah, but
so
we
probably crafty. The best DA you've got around is actually hot liquor water. You know, that's going to have a relatively low DA. But, you know, use block and bleeds. Use teas with valves at every critical control point you can. Keep your stuff packed with hot liquor water that's cooled or DA water, or just spend time blowing it out with CO2. You know, I mean, big breweries are looking for 50 ppb total package pickup. If you got a little bit of water left in your filter, you could get 300-500 ppm on one quick shot run by on a 40 by 40 plate and frame with 20 plates. You know, they can work for you. You just got to pay attention to it. And, you know, be cautious about your run up for a DE filter, because you might find that you're going to pick up a whole lot more DA from the DE if it's handled wrong than you would from a plate and frame that's not handled really well, you know. They can do great work for you for relatively low cost, relatively easy to operate. You just got to look at a couple of those things. And one other thing while you're at it is inspect that thing regularly. Make sure your gaskets are in great shape and there's no cracks in your plates. You know, you get a crack in a plate and you lose the integrity of that device when it's put together. That'll really start bumping up that number. That help?
Yeah, perfect. Thank you.
We stopped using plate and frame, and we now use colloidal silica, which I think there are probably a lot more people using it nowadays. Just we fine only. That's all we do.
You said you're bottling. Are you, like, doing bottles from a brew pub or bottles out in the market, like in store shelves?
Bottles out to market, store shelves in a relatively small area that will soon grow, and that's why I ask the question.
You guys self-distributing?
We just started distributing through somebody else up until a few months ago.
I'd invest in a DO meter. That's pretty important, because it's going to be a bit of a bite, but like Larry was saying, you can have hidden leaks throughout your whole process loop on filtration that you're not even aware of, you're not even going to see, that are going to could be really big DO pickup points, and you won't know it, you know, until it's too late.
Yeah, that's one of those things that wakes me up sometimes.
And I'm going to step on my soapbox about the DO for just a minute, and I will say before I give this speech that we do not currently own a DO meter. And so now I'm going to tell you to do as I say and not as I do. Go buy a DO meter. As a relatively small brew pub, we look at the price of this thing. You know, the Hock meters are what? Whether they're used or brand new, between 5 and 15. But this is a cap expense. You can lease this. There are plenty of organizations out there that will allow you to buy this device on time. And if you're going to package it, if you're going to buy a new packaging line, and I'm still on my soapbox for just a minute, you know, and you don't roll the cost of a new DO meter into either your new filter set or your new packaging set, then, you know, that's tough. That's probably the number one thing you can do outside of just good brewing practice in the brew house to make a positive impact of your beer on the market. You know, DO is not your friend.
I strongly agree with that. We have a portable DO meter. And we also have another one that's in line going where our product into the canning line is. So we can actually measure off just about anywhere in the brewery. We can take measurements and see where DO ingress is taking place. Highly recommend that. That's one of the big enemies.
Yeah, I would second that too. But just for general operating principle, what we do is we hot sanitize our plate and frame. Because as I think Larry said, that's got a very low, as far as, you know, water is concerned, other than DA water, pretty low oxygen content. And then we cool that down with DA water, but you can also just do it with beer. As far as the entire loop is concerned, I found that, you know, 9 times out of 10, pickup does not come from the plate and frame. If you've, you know, filled from the bottom, purged the water out and all that stuff, it's almost always, in my experience, from the suction side of your process pumps. Maybe it's a loose clamp or a bad seal or something like that, but you can take your portable meter around and you can find out exactly where it's coming from.
Or the piercing devices they also make, so you can actually see what's going on. Generally how we do that is we'll take one can or one bottle and we'll shake the hell out of it, and then we'll leave the other one unshaken, and it gives us a range, basically. So the non-shaken one always has a lower DO than the shaken one. But the shaken one, if it's excessively higher, that means you're getting a DO ingress at package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's TPO right there. But Yeah, that's a great point, because you can get a portable meter, a lot of times you can use that for package analyzing too. So you can just bring that from your filtration operation, take it out to packaging, and use it there too.
This made me think now. Thank you for that. On a related note, some people I've heard of when the beer, as soon as it hits the bright tank, the first thing they do is they scrub the oxygen out, basically send CO2 in, allowing headspace to be open, thinking that the CO2 is going to kick out any oxygen that might have been picked up in the lines or in the plate frame or whatever on the way. Is any of you guys who can measure these things, does that actually work?
Get the number down, but the question is, where'd the oxygen go, right? As soon as it hits the beer, it's doing the damage, right? That's why the big guys talk about total air, front to back, right? It's not 50 ppb today. It's how much was it on Monday, plus how much was it on Tuesday, plus how much was it in the transfer to the cellar and back out. You know, we don't have the tools necessarily to be super excellent about this or to get to those kind of standards. But, you know, while this is an issue of you're bringing down the number, but you're not solving the problem, right?
Right.
So by that point, it's too late. It's not a bad idea to scrub it out, but now you're scrubbing out aroma too. So mm-hmm. Trading one bad for another.
Yeah.
If you see a high DO in your bright tank, you can come back an hour later without doing anything, and it'll be lower. But it's because it's reacting.
Right.
Exactly. But for brights, you can. We're very, very careful about purging the oxygen out. A couple ways to do it is you can just, come in the bottom and vent it out the top real slow and eventually, call it good or measure it if you have the ability to. Or the other thing you can do is just pressurize it, wait, half an hour, and then you do have a stratification of gases in the tank. And then you can crack the top vent. And the CO2, as it expands, will push the headspace out. And you take that back down to near zero atmospheric and do that again. And after doing that a couple of times, generally you're pretty well purged. And you should be pretty good after that.
We actually did that on a... we've been successful with that. I think that's a Weihenstephan technique, isn't it?
I think a lot of people do that. Yeah, it's pretty effective, because if you don't have the way to measure the oxygen content of the gas that's coming out of the tank as you're venting, you're not really going to know necessarily
right.
When it's done. So that, hence the pressurization technique.
Found it works better on smaller tanks rather than larger tanks. That's just from what we found. Like 30 barrels and less, but once we start to get up to 60 and higher volume tanks, it doesn't tend to be quite as effective, but that's just from what we found.
I would be very careful with counting on the stratification technique too. I mean, there are a lot of big brewers out there who've done a fair amount of research about this. We tend to go straight to the it's heavier than air, it'll sink to the bottom paradigm. And practically speaking, to get to the levels of oxygen that you're looking to exclude, right? That's not your best practice. I mean, if you can do that, that's better than doing nothing. But if you've got the time and you've got the resources, blow CO2 through that tank for a good long while. Take an extra 10 or 15 minutes. Because, it might stratify, maybe, but what happens when you start pumping beer into the tank? Are you doing it aggressively? Are you not doing it aggressively? Are you counting on a relatively small amount of gas to protect a relatively large amount of relatively valuable beer? Purge it.
Yeah, there's a relatively inexpensive... air sampling device that you can get called from GasTech. Anybody use these? I think they were. I think they're about three grand or so. So that's that's money. But they are, I think, originally designed for, say, confined space entry. So for atmospheric testing before you go into a tank, and so they have an alarm on them, but you can disable that. And you just use it to sample your headspace gas. So you can maybe get one as a loaner or something like that and develop, the practice. But we found that the pressurizing and blowdown is pretty dang effective when you actually measure it. Works for us. You know, I guess tank dynamic, you know, tank geometry would influence that a lot. But, yeah, that's one method.
It's also, it's really hard to hold your seller accountable when you don't have a device like that. That actually would be the best way to go. And I think they're only about $3,000 or $4,000. You just hook it up to the top of the tank, and it basically tells you when you remove the majority of the O2 from the tank. It's hard to slap somebody on the wrist when they're all they're doing is standing by a port sniffing it
until they
just can't stand it anymore.
Yeah,
they're not extremely sensitive. It just goes off of a percentage of atmospheric composition. And so our spec has always been when you're at 1% or less oxygen, then you're fine. And that works really well for us.
I did find a relatively cheap device for this. There's a company on the web, and I'm sorry, I can't think of the name right now. They make these little personal atmosphere monitors that you're supposed to clip to your shirt so it'll tell you when you're dead. You've seen them, and they do exactly that. If you get the one that just measures percent oxygen in the atmosphere, you can zip tie that thing to the outblow on the tank and just wait till it beeps.
And you're dead.
Dead. No. Thank you, guys.
And I use canaries.
Did you want to add something to that?
Actually, the kind of answer that I was going to ask you about, you know, the sophistication, you need the Rolls-Royce system of oxygen detection, and do you have any rules of thumb for the amount of oxygen coming through? But I think it generally depends on those questions, unless you want to expand on it a little bit more, because you can go up to 20 to 40 grand for an oxygen detection meter or down to the simple meter. So I guess just again, I think you have touched on it already, but you want to reiterate any rules of thumb for the amount of oxygen you want to look for? I think you did a little bit there. Any other comments on what you consider acceptable going through in terms of oxygen?
For us, if we can get our product into the can and be less than 200 parts per billion, we consider we've done pretty well. But if we can get down below 100, we feel like we've done pretty damn well. You know, like, really well, actually. So. Those are just numbers that we usually see from our technology that we have.
Those are pretty good. I mean, how realistic would it be for a lot of
the
small guys just
to I'm sure you guys are familiar with the mobile bottling and canning lines that people are using. We had someone come by and do 16-ounce cans at our place about a week or two ago. And they have it's manual, so it has a manual steamer. It has two fill heads that you manually put cans into, and then when you take them off, they're foaming over, and you go straight to the steamer with them. So just about every single one that I saw him seamed on foam. So I took his cans and I took them down to the lab and I ran DO on them, shook one, and the other one's unshaken, and came back at 103. To 106 ppb, which is, in my opinion, amazing for someone who's standing there filling cans manually by hand and then just seaming. And I didn't just take the ones I just saw him seam off the line, you know, so I knew that he had, you know, like seamed on foam. I just took random cans he handed me. And then I went over and checked our line. We're running like 116 on unshaken and like just above 200 on shaken. So manually, he was actually getting better errors than we were running that day on our line. You can do a lot with some of the lines that they're making right now. It just depends on how labor intensive you want, you know, your employees to have to, you know, you want them to deal with that. And as you continue to have a piece of equipment that's more labor intensive, well, you need more labor, and that's not good. I'd much rather see our canning line run the rotary and have two people running that line than have like 4 to 6 people running a much more manual line.
All right, well, we've reached our time to end the panel. I want to thank you for participating. I want to thank the panelists. Please join me in thanking them for their insights this afternoon. Everybody have a great night.
If anybody had any other questions, just come on up.